This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And Ramon is present. Jonathan, I did the country a major duty by, unfortunately, reading the EFF manifesto over the weekend.
You did the country a major duty, and clearly you had a lot of time on your hands.
Well, no, it's an important civic duty that I took upon by myself, for myself and for the betterment of the masses, because we all know most school children can't read. So I thought perhaps I should make it a moral duty to that I read the manifesto, and I made a video of it, explaining to the people of South Africa what this means for them. And my conclusion was basically, if you love slavery and thought that the apartheid government, social engineering, just, wasn't done as well as one would have hoped, you should vote EFF.
All right, so EFF are going to bring back slavery? But you got criticism for that
online. Yeah, by the EFF, who cares? Read the manifesto. They're going to determine where you live, where you work. No property allowed. They're going to determine where your children go to school. They're going to determine which police station looks after you. They're going to determine various things.
They're also going to give you lots of free stuff. There's free housing. There's free schooling. There's free education. There's free healthcare. There's free unicorns. There's free everything for everyone. And you can have as many of them as you like. That sounds like an amazing deal.
Yeah, until you run out of other people's money, and then it's a fuck up. So
absolutely.
A small thing about manifestos generally, the longer the manifesto, the more oppressive the political party. So tonight, we thought perhaps we should speak to another political party, the leader of the Cape Party, Mr. Jack Miller, whose manifesto is only 22 pages. So Jack, welcome to the Renegade Report, and congratulations on having such a short manifesto.
Thank you, Roman. Thank you, Jonathan. It's good to be with you guys. Yeah, I think to follow on from what you're saying there, there is a strong sign around the world where governments that have reams and reams of legislation, they basically they legislate into criminality the average citizen who, on a day-to-day basis, is exposed to so many meaningless and unnecessary laws which infringe on our basic freedoms, which I know yourself as a libertarian, I think you can strongly identify with. So, yeah, at the Cape Party manifesto, our issues are quite clear. It's not a short manifesto, but it's a concise manifesto. So, we get to the point, we don't need to get caught in the mud of communism and social engineering and fascism, which means that you need to, down to the finest detail, dictate the lives of people. So we certainly believe in a far more liberty-minded and free-spirited society.
So for the listeners out there, Jonathan, I'm going to let you have the first question, but I approve of secession. Jonathan thinks it's madness. So, Jonathan, first question for you, sir.
Let's get to the madness a bit later. Let's start with something easy. What are you doing on beaches sacrificing watermelons?
Anyone who is listening to the news over December, I think will have seen, the EFF, BLF, and other groups slaughtering that white sheep on Clifton Beach, singing One Settler, One Bullet. And it was such a blatant act of racism, in spite of their the facade of what they claimed to be doing it for. And so, it was very out of place too. They were a long way from home. That's not the way that the people of the Cape behave. We do not sacrifice animals on our beaches. and we thought we'd make a comical parody of the event and do something that is an old Cape tradition, and that is to share watermelon with friends.
Yeah, but where I'm from, I thought, watermelons were racist.
Where you're from? Where are you
days,
from, Roman?
These days in South Africa, everything is racist.
No, but there's a well-known meme about black Americans liking watermelon. But all right, I mean, I got the parody. People thought it was real and then took the piss because they thought it was real, despite not knowing it was a parody. So I don't know if that's very brilliant parody or terrible parody, but it doesn't matter. It got you media attention, which is exactly what you wanted. So, kudos for that. So reading your manifesto, and I believe, our listeners should read it. It's only 22 pages long. You make quite a, how can I explain, a case for the fact that the Cape is different, markedly different from other parts of South Africa. So in a few paragraphs, why would you say it is that different from the rest of the country?
Well, the Cape is as unique to South Africa as KwaZulu-Natal is unique to South Africa, and Lesotho is unique to South Africa, and Botswana, etc. So, a lot of people are not familiar with the history which formed us, and I think it's important for us to understand where we came from and how this state was created and what it's caused. And so prior to 1910, the Cape was self-governing from 1872 to 1910. You had independent countries in the form of the Transvaal Republic and the Free State, as well as Lesotho and Swaziland, as well as other tribal chiefdom areas. And it was only after the British, through two bloody wars and genocide, concentration camps, were they able to crush the will of resistance of this part of Southern Africa and force us from independent countries into a unitary state called the Union of South Africa. And since 1910 until today, we've had three different political entities, centralized political entities, each serving their and their group's own best interest to the detriment of all others. So we had the British Empire or their stooges from 1910 to 1948. From 1948 to 1994, we had the NAT government, which was based in Transvaal. And then from 94 till today, we've got the ANC regime. Every single one of them used those central levers of power to their own benefit, to the detriment of others. What we're saying at the Cape Party is that we need to put an end, and this is where we will agree with the ANC and the EFF, and we need to put an end to this colonial mistake. South Africa is a colonial mistake. No one here voted for this democratically. This was imposed on us by the British Empire, and it has resulted in over a century of tremendous suffering. And the Cape has a history that goes back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. We've got a multi-ethnic culture with Dutch, Khoisan, French Huguenot, Indonesian, Malaysian. Afrikaans is basically a mixture of Dutch and Khoisan and Indonesian. It's a beautiful confluence of different cultures, which through the umbilical cords of the oceans from the east to the west formed the bedrock of what is Cape culture and has become the Cape of Good Hope.
Okay, so we'll get to the whole notion of secession, but if the Cape province was its own province, and I assume that just means the Western Cape as it is viewed today, how come some guy who semigrated to the Cape 5 years ago from Joburg, how can he claim any right to this heritage? And when you secede, how come he has a right to be part of your sort of nation, which he actually has no heritage or belonging to in terms of a historical one, versus those people who would claim some sort of historical claim to the Cape?
Yeah, I think that's the confusion with with what we're pushing for. You know, the reason culture and language is, you know, an important topic in secession is because, first of all, we were promised a dream of a rainbow nation in 1994, and the ANC today is the polar opposite of that. The reason why there is this, I think, support in the Western Cape for this concept, and polls we've conducted have shown unbelievable popularity in the idea of Cape independence. And I think that's because there is such an attack against the Afrikaans language and the basically the ethnic groups which make up 70% of the Western Cape population. 70% of the Cape population is either colored, white, Indian, or Asian, speaks Afrikaans or English as a first language. And the ANC has explicitly gone out to attack all of these groups. And so this is why Cape independence, I think, is so popular here in the Cape. But our reasons for doing it is more than just that. It's more than the fact that we're under racial and cultural attack here in the Cape. It's that we want a country that just works, for goodness sake.
What do you make of the sort of argument then that, you know, it's very easy to come in and to arguably come into the best working province in the country, that are based on Auditor General reports. You know, say, well, yes, we want this part to come out because it's kind of the least corrupt, the most successful, you know, you could have some arguments around Gauteng being perhaps the most successful business-wise, but it's definitely a successful province. It runs relatively well. It's so easy to do that when you're cherry-picking that province. And why don't you, if you want Cape secession, why don't you want the Cape, the Western Cape, the Northern Cape, and the Eastern Cape, for example?
Sorry, what's
The thing is why pick that province alone? What makes the Western Cape so special, other than the fact that it's obviously special in the sense that it's in our country currently with 9 provinces, it's kind of the best one, so to speak, in terms of the way that it functions currently, because it's had relatively good governance for the past decade and a half.
Well, there are two provinces that are, you know, primary revenue producers, and that's the Western Cape and Gauteng. So, you know, we're certainly not alone. KwaZulu-Natal is also very economically strong. And so the Western Cape, we're under direct economic attack by the through the Division of Revenue Act, which extracts 200 billion rand in taxes from us every year. We get allocated back a mere 50 billion rand. And so with that that discrepancy and that economic oppression that we're suffering under, that results in serious unemployment issues, housing issues, infrastructure issues, medical issues. And so charity starts at home, and we need to look after the best interests of the people here in the Cape. And the model that we would propose is something that we believe would be to the benefit of any entity that adopted this. You've got to be able to break through these restrictive centralized political policies which stagnate the economy and shrink the pie as opposed to growing the pie. And so we've got to start here in the Cape. This is where we're based. But, you know, we would promote this in any other province too.
All right. So let's take the hypothetical. The Cape manages to secede de facto or de jure. I think it'll happen de facto, by the way. I think the central government will lose a lot of money and power in the upcoming decade or so. So you recommend direct democracy. So direct democracy is a system that is mostly found in Switzerland. It works very well there. They've had it for hundreds and hundreds of years. How do you impose direct democracy into the Cape where it was never really an option, or there's no culture of direct democracy? Because essentially you want to hold referendums for basically everything, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's the whole world is moving in this direction. I think this is why we can see the European Union collapsing and various movements around the world pushing for a more direct democratic type of system. And that's because centralization has failed. It's failed wherever it's been applied. And you get different forms of centralization. What the ANC is pushing here, is communist socialism that is the worst form. I mean, expropriation without compensation is the worst form of fascist communism. And so it's unique to places like Switzerland. Obviously, the federal system that the United States was built upon, the federal principalities that formed Germany. So there are historical reference points for this, but it would be fairly revolutionary in that sense. And it's the only system that works. So the Cape would be a perfect model in which to apply this direct democratic system, especially considering the multi-ethnic cultures that we have. And look, we would probably break the Cape Republic down into sort of 62 contiguous municipalities that would have a great control over the policies that they made and the taxes that they lived under.
So I think Ramon thinks that sounds like pretty good, and I was going to say heaven, but I think Ramon would like it broken down even further. He'd break it down into 6,200 municipalities. So I'm interested to get into some of the policy stuff as per your manifesto, but let's talk about the idea of secession. I mean, there's both the idea philosophically, and then there's the practical aspects to the idea. So I commented to Ramon not too long ago when I knew you were coming on the show that I felt that Ramon's approach to secession and yours were different, because in essence, Ramon, and he can jump in and correct me any time he wants if I'm misrepresenting him, but he would like everything to break down to the smallest possible agreement that is available. So literally neighbors agreeing to build the road outside their house or trade services or whatever it happened to be. And that's his sort of anarchy, and that's his view of where we should devolve in terms of government. As far as I can understand, because you're a party, you're still a political party. So if you were to succeed and in secession, then what ends up happening is all you're going to do is you're going to replicate government, but at a slightly smaller level. So, I mean, it's better because it's smaller because, well, it's a national government over a nation of Cape Town or a nation of the Cape rather than a nation of the whole of South Africa. But it's still a government. And how is that any different in its inefficiencies and its corruption? You almost do run the Republic of Cape Town currently, and you had Patricia de Lille recently involved in a whole bunch of scandal down there. Arguably, the city certainly, many people feel, doesn't run as well since Helen Zille's not involved. It'll be interesting to see what happens to the province when she's not involved in the province anymore following next year. So I'm just interested to understand why you think maybe you guys can run a government better than the ANC can. And I know that's a very low bar. So I've really set you up there.
There's a certain point at which the distance between community and the administrative functions of a state become too stretched that they lose accountability. And the key question behind all of this is accountability. And there's a big difference to having, even within Cape Town, having a mayor that has got complete, veto control over the policies that the citizens of the city live under. For example, the Boer Kaap, which is a majority Muslim area, they're under extreme pressure because they have different values to some of the areas that live around them. You know, the same with Khayelitsha and Durbanville and Brackenfell. You know, each area has got unique issues, and the more you centralize things, the less accountability you have. So, for example, if you know the person, perhaps not personally, but let's say the mayor of your community, the governing, the administrative official for your community, and he lives, you know, five roads down from you, and you bump into him at the shopping center, you know, every other week, and there is a transparent bank account into which, you know, taxes are paid and auditing for – it's much easier to audit, you know, affairs that are more local than trying to manage a massive centralized state with so much centralized power that you lose accountability. And as a result, you see every government in the world, be it the ANC, be it the American government, be it the European Union, it doesn't matter. All of these centralized states will use this smokescreen of distance from the people that elected them to serve them to their own best interests. So direct democracy and running a decentralized see, this is the Cape Party wouldn't – we would not run the Cape Republic. We would put in place a constitution and policies that would give tremendous voting rights down to the communities in which they live. No one understands the issues of Boerkaap better than the people of Boerkaap. Nobody understands the issues of Langebaan better than the people who live in Langebaan and in Upington and Hermanus and etc. So we would flip the decision-making process on its head. And this is how the Cape Party is fundamentally different to the ANC and the DA too, which frankly, a lot of people are now calling ANC light. The DA's policies are starting to mirror the ANC's, and to tell the truth, there's very little distinction between them when it comes to their macro views of governance.
Yeah, I think that's what people don't really get about direct democracy. It's about giving as much power locally. And that power is emergent. And so there's more power on the street level than the power at the municipal level, than power at the federal level. So, for example, in Switzerland, I actually met the federal president of Switzerland. He was sitting at a hotel bar when I was present, and I had no idea he was the president of Switzerland. His only job is to go to the UN every now and again to represent his country, but he drives an A4 Audi. And okay, he had a driver, but he looks like a mid-level accountant in a big firm. Yeah. So this is the leader of Switzerland, and no one knew his name. No one. I only found out after the fact. The waiter said that was the federal president of Switzerland, who walks around freely without bodyguards, has one driver, drives an A4. But if you go, I assume in Switzerland, if you go to the actual canton, if you speak to the mayor of the canton, I assume he has a lot more power within that canton than the federal president could ever hope to have. So in a scenario where the K party is, okay, governing might be the wrong word, but the Boerkaap will have its representative. The, you know, Khayelitsha will have its representative, and they will meet every so often at the Cape Parliament with a mandate from that from their community about something or other. Then they vote on that mandate as a collective, one assumes. I mean, that's the effective way to run the Cape, in your opinion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You've got to give communities the, you know, I don't even like the word give. You know, essentially, we've grown so out of touch with what the function of a state should even be, where these government officials are so arrogant. The ANC is so arrogant on a national level, and the DA is so arrogant on a provincial level. And that's because they both have vast majorities. And the DA doesn't serve the citizens of the Western Cape that have put them into power. They rule over them. And we've had to take on a number of court cases for communities here. For example, Patricia DeLille put up cell phone towers right in front of a school creche and communities there that really didn't want it, and there was a whole uproar, and they just steamrolled it through. And we had to step in and take legal action to defend them and actually win the case and to have that reversed. But most people, you know, they're just it costs an absolute fortune to take legal action like that. And it's absurd. It's absurd that some politician living far away from you could decide a matter so important that it affects your daily life or your children's daily life. And that needs to change. And politicians need to realize that they've been put there by voters to serve the voters' best interest. And we're simply saying at the K Party, we need to have a constitution, a political framework that reflects the fact that voters are the ones whose best interests should be seen to, and the taxes that we pay are there to facilitate that these politicians simply fulfill the administrative duties to carry out the will of the people. And that's how far we've drifted from it, and that's what we're trying to bring back.
Right, and I'm just going to jump in quickly, Jonathan, because another essence of direct democracy is that it's actually being a politician is actually sort of like a part-time job. It's like being a city councillor as opposed to a full-time employed politician. And an important aspect of direct democracy is nullification, which you have elucidated in your manifesto. And nullification is that if a law is passed within your country, as a community, you can actually revoke that law so it doesn't apply to your community. Now, if that is not democracy at its finest, I don't know what is.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And there's others to go with it. Referendums, initiatives, recall, nullification, and voluntary secession would be another. And you need to have checks and balances to ensure that these politicians keep in line and the ultimate buck starts and ends with the voter and the local community. Another point that I want to add to your listeners who perhaps aren't familiar with the system of direct democracy and the Swiss Canton system is that they don't have one president. You happen to meet the president who was in charge for that year. They've got a presidential council of seven that rotates on an annual basis. And it's simply an administrative role for these individuals to rubber stamp the policies which are decided, as you said, by the various cantons through the layers of government. And so the K Party does not want to see any type of top-down dictatorship. You know, I would not be the president of the Cape Republic. I would simply facilitate us getting to that point if I stick around long enough. But the type of country we would have would be where there is no president as such. You simply have someone that fulfills the task that the community decides. And at the end of the day, a referendum, an initiative, a recall, nullification like you spoke about, the citizen at the ballot box is essentially the president.
Okay, so fine. I think that gives people enough insight into the philosophical side and the logic behind going with something like secession. What about the practical aspects? So this is two-sided. One is, why not, if this is such a good idea, why not try to convince the whole country to go this way? Why not have just hundreds of communities across the country have this move to this type of democracy? Why target the Cape? And the other side of the coin is, these are fun debates to have on Facebook groups and in sort of side conversations over a beer. But at the end of the day, what about those people who say you are not going to be able to separate a state from the or a province from the rest of the country? It's not going to happen either by any sort of legal method, and if you try to do it any other way, you will lose, i.e. militarily.
Well, first of all, we do promote it for other provinces. And I guess the idea that taking control over your own community is sort of implied in our name, the Cape Party, you know, this is where we're based. We are a province which suffers the worst discrimination at the hands of the ANC due to our cultural, linguistic, and ethnic majority population here. So that's why the Cape Party is pushing for, first of all, the federal system. But if the ANC will not negotiate with us on that basis, then complete self-governance. And so we would promote that in KwaZulu-Natal and the Eastern Cape, and et cetera. But those communities will have to make that decision themselves. It'd be lovely, I think, for us to and on that note, there are movements that we are in contact with. We've got good relationships with the Abatembu tribe in the Eastern Cape that is calling for Eastern Cape independence. We've got good relationships with a group called the Shaka Zulu Nation, and they are calling for independence for KwaZulu-Natal. We don't need to look too much further around South Africa to see that the Sotho's have got their own country called the Sotho. The Swazis have their own country called Swaziland, or Eswazi now. The Tswanas have their own country called Botswana. So this is something that is not, I think, too unfamiliar. And I certainly see the murmurings and the seeds of this certainly taking place. And I think that's what Raman was sort of referring to as well. There'll almost be a de facto decentralizing of political power. And I think this is what we're seeing in the European Union too, you know, with Brexit and with Catalonia and with Italy putting in power a government that's very pro-Italian. So I think we're seeing these forces emerging throughout the world.
Yeah, I really hope it's not false hope by any means. So let's talk about the Cape Party specifically. Now, Jack, I'm going to be a bit frank. I love the idea. I love secession. I love direct democracy. I love nullification. What has prevented you from being more successful? What has prevented people within the Western Cape from seeing you as an equal political party to the main ones within the Western Cape at a provincial level? Because it appears to me, I know of you because I like the ideas, but I speak to many people and they think like you're kooks, like you're just crazy whack jobs. Why do you think that persists? Or do you think it's just, is it just a lack of budget at the end of the day?
That's a huge factor. We're a grassroots organization. We survive on the donations of our supporters, and it's meager compared to the budgets that the DA has and the ANC has. Their budgets are over R1 billion each. So we are nowhere near that. So we really would call upon businesses and individuals to support us, because we have a message that's incredibly important, and I think perhaps this is a message that it did sound crazy 10 years ago when we were founded in 2007, but it's not so crazy anymore. And the more we head towards a Zimbabwe-type situation, and the more fascist and racist the ANC becomes, the more groups like the EFF and BLF are spurred on to say some of the incredibly racist things that they're saying, the idea of Cape independence becomes far more popular. So, and that trend, I would say, started really kicking off about 2 years ago. So I agree with you. 10 years ago, the support for us wasn't very big. And I think the concept was perhaps too early. People weren't quite ready for it. But I do think, looking around the world today, that there is a breaking point has been passed, a tipping point, the apex of the pendulum has, I think, reached its peak and is now swinging back. And people are so sick and tired of centralization and the elites imposing austerity measures on them and central governments taxing people into extinction. And no one benefits from that type of situation, not the poor, not the middle class, not the businesses and the people who are working and getting taxed to death. No one benefits. It's a cancerous state that is so inefficient that basically parasitically destroys the wealth of a nation. And the grassroots are starting to wake up to that. So I think that's why Cape Independence is far more popular now than it was 10 years ago. And I think we're going to see that trend continue.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about some of your policies themselves. I mean, some of them are, I think, relatively well thought out. Some I feel could have a bit more meat on the bones. Do you want to talk about some of your major sort of proposals that are in your manifesto in terms of how you would do things differently? You know, the big things: education, housing, employment, healthcare, etc.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and it goes back to what I mentioned earlier. And it's impossible to do something without the resources. And the Division of Revenue Act, which robs us of 75% of the revenue that we produce here, by taking control of those resources, it would be mind-blowing how much we would be able to apply that into the education system, the hospital system, infrastructure, and also to change the way things are done. For example, we really promote the involvement of parents in and communities in the education of their children, as opposed to state-run education, which invariably warps history and warps economics and anything that legitimizes their existence and their thievery. So we would fundamentally change the schooling system. We'd fundamentally change. We'd be able to give a surge of support and energy into, for example, housing. We have severe housing issues here with our majority population, the colored community, living in cardboard shacks and in backyard dwellings, because they're not black enough. And there's, you know, a comment that we often hear in the colored communities is that ons was tweede klas burgers onder die ou regering, and now is ons derde klas burgers. So, you know, they basically say that things are much worse in the colored community now than it was even under apartheid. So we've got to address these issues. And a lot of it, a lot of the improvements we would see in an independent Cape would come about as a result of putting an end to the discriminative policies of the ANC and a far more decentralized distribution of revenue in the Western Cape that actually went to the people that need it most and the areas that need it most.
Yeah, because the aspect of the weird thing about national policy is like a sort of one size fits all, but South African racial groups and ethnic groups, and even amongst ethnic groups and racial groups in and of themselves, is so different. I mean, to have demographically representational BEE in, I'm really sorry, that's my pug. She's trying to vomit. But to have demographically representational BEE in the Western Cape is fucking absurd. It is utterly absurd because the black people are not a majority in the Western Cape. So why would you want people who don't live there to have 80% of the houses or the jobs or whatever other, you know, governmental goodies they want to give to their people, air quotes. It is absolutely absurd. So even that notion and the fact that people think that it's all right that coloureds do not form part of BEE in a province where they are the majority is absurd and a horrific form of social engineering.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, just listen to the comments from Jimmy Money, you know, where he was saying that the colours need to stop complaining and move to another province so they can represent the demographics of South Africa, which we know is an artificial state. You know, the Cape is its foundation is built upon this multi-ethnic confluence of different cultures and groups that have made the Cape home. And you know, another point that I like to refer to, the ANC and the EFF like to paint this picture as if, you know, when colonialism arrived or when the Dutch settlers arrived in 1652, there's nothing but rape and murder and pillaging. It's the biggest load of rubbish. The most powerful man, well, the very first governor of the Cape in, I think it was 1672, the very first governor of the Cape was a man by the name of Simon van der Stel. And Simon van der Stel is who Stellenbosch was named after him. And he was the most powerful man almost 400 years ago. And he was a man of mixed race. He was a colored man. Now, how is it possible then that there was all of this racial oppression and murdering and rape when the most powerful man in the Cape late 1600s was a colored man? And certainly, historically, there are terrible you know, accounts of slavery and things like that. But the Cape was basically built upon a system that in its time brought about many different cultures coming together. And when slavery came to an end, you saw the merging of all of these groups. And even before, when the Dutch arrived in 1652, they were only men. They ended up intermarrying with the Khoisan. And this was the beginning, as well as slaves coming from Indonesia and Malaysia. And this was the beginning of the colored population. And the same with Afrikaans. It's a merging of all of these cultures. So for the ANC to then come in the year 2000 and basically say that the demographics of the Cape is wrong and that these people who've been living here for hundreds and hundreds of years, many, many generations, need to migrate to other provinces in South Africa because they're the wrong skin color in the province that they find themselves is pure racism and, like you say, it's social engineering. So, you know, we need to fight back against racism, and we need to call the ANC out and the EFF out on their policies. The true racist in this country is the South African government, is the ANC, is the EFF.
Well, I can't disagree with you there. Sorry, Jonathan, just one anecdote about Simon van der Stel. He married, I believe, one of his slaves. I can't remember for the life of me, I can't remember her name. And she inherited his estate when he passed away, making her a free woman and the richest woman in the Cape by a country mile. Ironically, she had slaves of her own once she became a free woman. So you can see this, the decolonized narrative about white oppression and black oppression is completely false, specifically in the Cape. And if you look at the Boers and the Zulus fighting together against the British, the Zulus gave the Boers their own republic, the Republic of Natalia, that existed for 4 years. Mfikane, where the Zulus took over, caused the land and went all the way up to, I believe it was Botswana even, where 1.1 million ethnic blacks died in that conflict. Yeah. You know, it's a time of imperialism, and that's what happens. And it's imperialist from the Dutch, from the Zulus, from anyone you can think of. It's just the way history was done. Thankfully, it's not done that way anymore. Now we've got technocratic socialism, which is a lot more subtle and possibly a lot more evil too.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, do you erase Alexander the Great from history? Do you erase Napoleon from history? You know, you mentioned the Mfukane, and the greatest loss of black life in Southern Africa's history was at the hands of Shaka Zulu in the Mfukane. So, you know, South Africa's got a very complex history, and yes, apartheid was wrong. Yes, slavery was wrong. Yes, the Mfukane was wrong. This was the climate of the times back then. And like you say, thank goodness we're living in a new world, and we've got opportunities now to make things better for everyone. And just to add a little bit more to sort of direct democracy earlier, you know, we've got the advent of the internet, where why should we have to wait once every 5 years to decide who should be making decisions for us in government? You know, we have the capabilities now to develop a mobile app on our phones that can recall politicians if they step out of line, that can you know, bring attention to a pothole that needs to be fixed, or high crime areas, or, you know, we can vote on these issues through secure mobile apps these days. So, you know, it's and the blockchain as well, where it's verifiable, and you eradicate any possibilities for corruption. So there are so many things that we can do in today's modern era. And if we keep on living, looking in the rearview mirror, we're going to miss the opportunities to really make a better world. And if we are going to look at that rearview mirror, well, let's look at that rearview mirror in its entirety. Let's not start history in 1948 with the terrible apartheid regime. You know, let's go back. Let's talk about the Mfukane. Let's talk about the extermination of the Khoisan as the Bantu tribes moved from Central Africa down through to the Fish River, where was the point at which in the Zuurveld they made contact with the inward-moving Boers, and the Boers were trying to get away from the British, who were terrible to the Boers. So, you know, there's a long history of complex conflicts, and so the ANC and the EFF need to look at history in its entirety, and let's look forward and how we can make this country a better place. We think we've got the perfect model and idea. We're starting it here at home, here in the Cape, but we would certainly suggest that the residents of the Eastern Cape, the residents of KwaZulu-Natal, would look to us and say, well, you know, maybe we've got a pretty good plan here, and we can live peacefully together as neighbors and judge each other on our qualities, on our merit, on our character, as opposed to what the ANC is pushing for now, which is literally its national socialism, its social engineering, and with an exclusive racial agenda, blacks-only agenda. And if you look at what happened in Germany in the 1930s, also national socialists with an exclusive racial agenda for Germans alone. Was it all Germans? No. It was a small percentage of Germans who managed to take control over the levers of power. And what we have in South Africa today is a small portion, a faction that has taken over the ANC, the EFF, with a national socialist agenda, pushing for an exclusive black compensation. And so there's no difference between what we have today under the ANC as black Nazis compared to what has happened historically in Nazi Germany. And so we believe that what the battle is today is not necessarily different ethnic groups having to fight each other about the past, but we believe that we can decentralize power. And it's the black Nazis versus the rainbow nation. And here in the Cape, we really can have a rainbow nation based on those principles of loving your neighbor.
Sure. I have a problem with that description, though. I mean, you know, that's a racial description of people and using you know, some of the worst people in history to describe them. I mean, if you'd said, I mean, firstly, the ANC isn't ethnically cleansing anyone. They have very bad ideas, and I think my track record on my podcast is very clear how I feel about them. But I think it's a bit insincere and quite dangerous to refer to them as Nazis, and I certainly don't think that their race has anything to do with their behavior.
Well, I think if you look at their policies, it's National Socialism. And you listen to Julius Malema's comments in that one interview where he said, we're not calling for the killing of all whites yet. So we may not be where Germany was in the late 30s, but we're seeing signs that the government is talking. Its rhetoric is very, very dangerous. And there is no doubt that there are parallels with the ANC's rhetoric and the rhetoric of the Nazis.
All right, I'll leave it on that one. I wanted to, just before we wrap up, because I know we're on a bit of a tight schedule, your manifesto is a lot about immigration and the impact that immigration has had. Of course, Helen Zille's famous sort of tweet about educational refugees, if I'm not mistaken, or it might have been healthcare refugees. I don't remember exactly the terms, but basically she's talking about people coming from the Eastern Cape to use services in the Western Cape because they had collapsed in the Eastern Cape. You talk a lot about immigration. Someone who might be reading your manifesto, especially journalists on the left, will look at your manifesto and say, well, this looks very isolationist. You speak about things I'm quite interested in, so strong borders, for example, but you also speak quite strongly about immigrants in ways that people may find off-putting. What do you feel about that kind of commentary?
I don't think we've said anything disparaging. I think what we've done is we've focused on the negatives. What we've basically said is, how is it possible that a majority population here at home can be disregarded and have to live in backyard shacks because they're not the right skin color? So we're basically saying that charity starts at home. And this internal migration from other parts of South Africa and other parts of Africa is putting a tremendous strain on the resources available to the local inhabitants of the Cape. And so we're simply saying that we need to look after the people who've been living here for generations and generations first before we start addressing the needs of others.
Ramon, anything from you, your side?
Yeah, I think that's a valid thing. I think community and localism is much more important than nationalism and provincialism, if such a thing exists. Not that I think it does exist, but I mean, as I said, I like the idea. I think the ANC are dangerous. I wouldn't call them Nazis quite yet. I think they a sort of weird mix between like hardcore communists, who are the non-corrupt ones, funny enough. For some reason the communists are very disciplined. They, you know, the revolution needs discipline and a well-maintained civic service, and I'm sure they are absolutely disheartened that the ANC have gone on a looting spree, because that prevents the National Democratic Revolution from carrying on. But in the sense that the ANC wants to completely dominate South Africa, not just economically, but culturally as well, they want to dominate it in various other ways. I think it's very important that people do stand up for their rights to say that we don't want to be part of this revolution that you're talking about. We are happy to live here as a community, to put bread on the tables for our children, to go to school that we choose them to go to. And I think, you know, the direct democracy route is a very fair way to do it. But once again, I fear that perhaps, Jack, is the Cape Party the best exemplar or the best conduit to spread these ideas? Or is it just a case of being patient and these ideas will come more important over time?
Yeah, I think there are economic forces that, you know, for example, you look at the advent of cryptocurrencies that are challenging the conventional financial system. If you look at how people communicate through social media, they don't get their sources of information from one central news source, a newspaper. You know, your vlog, for example, is an example of that. I think we're seeing signs, and crime is so bad in this country. So you've got a tremendous industry that has grown out of private security and private schooling too, and across the board. I mean, private schooling might sound like it's only for those who can afford it to go to elite schools. That's not the case at all. The largest percentage growth for private schools was actually in informal settlements, some of the poorer communities that are paying, you know, 500 rand, you know, just so that their kid can get a proper education. So we are seeing signs that people are taking the functions of government as the government fails so dismally to provide those services. You're seeing the free market respond in a way that provides these avenues for people to essentially govern themselves. So is the political route the only route that could result in independence for the Cape and self-governance for other regions in South Africa? No, it's not the only route, but it's certainly, we think, quite an effective route to put the concept on the map and get people thinking in this direction and understanding that it's a possibility.
Cool. Well, Jack, thank you for joining us. I appreciate you taking the time and answering some tough questions. And yeah, let people have a listen and let them make up their minds if they feel that this is something that they want to vote for in the next elections.
Awesome. Thank you, Jonathan.
I just wanted to know, Jonathan, are you sort of do you understand the idea better now, or are you still?
It wasn't that I didn't understand it, Ramon. It's I still think it's a concept that could be done across the country. So I don't see a reason why one province needs to happen. Although I understand the argument of this is where we come from and this is where we are. So we're not worrying about other communities. We're worrying about our community. I get that, but I also think there's a very practical aspect to this As Jack repeatedly stated, the tax revenue from the Cape is more than 200 billion a year. If you think a national government is going to relinquish that, given that they own most of the guns, you've got another thing coming. So even if you think it's a great idea, even if you think it's the best thing to ever happen, and even if you get enough votes, I don't see it happening. But hey, maybe I'm wrong.
I already have a solution. Walls and drone armies. Walls and drone armies.
Yes. We've discussed your drone armies.
All right. Drone armies are great.
For a solo show, perhaps.
Perhaps. Maybe that's our next one. But, Jack, thank you so much for joining us on a very late evening. If people want to know more about the Gay Party and about you, where can they find that?
They can go to our website at kparty.com. They can send us an email at cape@kparty.com. They can check us out on Twitter and Instagram. We're not hard to find.
Perfect. And yes, I recommend everyone read the manifesto because it has important political principles that I hold dear, like direct democracy and nullification, which to me are the cornerstones of democracy. And the K Party, as far as I'm aware, is the only one that actually mentions those things in a manifesto. So it is something, you know, off the tennis court, but it is vitally important to understand it within a liberal democratic context in which we find ourselves. And I use the term liberal very loosely. But Jack, once again, thank you. Much appreciated for your time to come on. And I can only wish you the best of luck.
Thanks so much, Ramon. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jack. Cheers, man.
Thanks, Jonathan.
As As always, guys, you can catch us on Facebook, both the page and the group. You can find us on Twitter at @Renegade_Report. You can always support us using PayPal. Website promise is coming. Yes, Ramon?
Yes, no, the website's almost ready. And now we're on YouTube, Jonathan. So I make lots of grand videos.
Ramon is very busy making lots of videos.
Great, great videos about why EFF is slavery.
The best videos, Ramon. The best videos.
Huge.
Huge.
PewDiePie told me they're the best videos he's ever seen.
Great. Great. So, and as always, we'd love you to follow us, to subscribe to us on YouTube. We're going to build that as we go through the year. And a whole bunch of other exciting things coming as we go through the year. So thanks as always for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
This is CliffCentral.com.